Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you. Wow, you guys are good already. My name is Jay Schmelzer, and I'm one of the directors of program management on the Visual Studio team at Microsoft. So to decode that for you a little bit, if you haven't been able to figure it out over the course of the week, as a program manager, we're the folks that sit on the engineering team and are responsible really for the design of our products. So it's my team's responsibility to look after a lot of aspects of Visual Studio, specifically what we think of as, the tools for business application development. So I think about, and my team thinks about that broad space, and then we get specialized in a few areas where we own the entire tool set. So for folks building solutions against or deploying to Office or SharePoint, that's part of my team. Windows Azure, that's part of my team. And then the thing that we're going to talk about today is the newest member of the Visual Studio product family, the Lightswitch product. So that's a little bit of kind of what I own. As part of that job, I obviously get the opportunity to come out, talk to folks like you about what we're doing. It is very helpful for me as part of these as well to try to gauge your reaction to some things, see if we're headed in the right direction or the wrong direction. So I'll be looking at your faces, seeing what you like, what you don't like. Of course, feel free to let me know during, before, after, what things you like and what you don't. That's the best way for us to build a product that you're going to like is to actually know what you want to do with it. So what I thought we would do today, I guess first let me do some show of hands exercises. How many folks were at my session on Monday where we talked about the HTML stuff? Okay. Not as many as I would have liked to see go up, but that's okay. if we have time at the end, I'll show that again really quick if there's interest. But we've got a lot of other stuff to pack in. How many folks are familiar with Visual Studio Lightswitch or building applications using it today? Okay. How many folks are familiar with it, though, and kind of feel like you know what it is? Okay. Well, what I thought we'd do then, I'll spend just a few minutes to level set so that everybody's got the same context of what we're trying to do around this. And then we'll jump in and really start digging into some more meat. What I thought we would do for this session is really try to focus on a lot of kind of the core experiences of the product, look at what's new with the Visual Studio 2012 version of the product, and then get into some of the more, it's kind of weird to use the term advanced when you talk about something like Lightswitch, but some of the more advanced capabilities of the product. For the context for this, if you were at the keynote, you saw Jason use this kind of Contoso moving app that was built in Lightswitch. Sort of the storyline behind that is imagine it's a moving company. You've got someone using this desktop application to handle scheduling of moves, scheduling of appointments for people that can go check up on things like that. What I thought we would do is take that as the base of our session today, and I've gone and I've pulled a bunch of things out of it that we'll go add back in and just to help you get a visual and to see how some of these things work as part of the product. So we'll go from creating a project all the way through talking about how we do deployment, and in the middle, we'll get into advanced business rule capabilities, authentication, authorization, all of those kind of things. Sound like a good set of stuff? All right. And you know what? Because it is the last day of Tech Ed and the last afternoon, and it is right after lunch, what I thought we would do is just do demos. Is that cool? All right. Yeah, of course you guys think it's cool. It's a nightmare for me, but we'll see what we can do. We've got a decent-sized audience. I got a lot of content to go through. If you have a burning question, feel free to raise your hand, yell it out. We'll try to take a few along the way. If you guys get out of hand with too many questions, I might ask you to stop, and we'll hold them till the end. But I'm fine if you guys have some questions that are burning and you want to ask them along the way, we can do that. All right. This is Visual Studio 2012, the release candidate. I am using the professional version of the product. Starting with in Visual Studio 2012, Lightswitch is just part of the product now. In the first version, we shipped it as an out-of-band thing because we were a little bit off-cycle from the rest of Visual Studio. So it was a download you had to add into Professional, Premium, or Ultimate, or it was also available as its own standalone version. Now in Visual Studio 2012, it's just part of the product. So if you get Visual Studio Professional, Premium, or Ultimate, you have Lightswitch. Now my machine also has the HTML thing on it. So there are a couple places where you're going to see something a little, it's going to look a little different. I'll try to point those out. But it's just a little change we made as part of supporting the HTML thing. But everything I'm going to show you, you can do with the release candidate of Visual Studio 2012 right now if you go download it and start working. Okay. As part of our level set and context, let's just create a new application. I'll call this a Hello World application in terms of Lightswitch, but as you'll see, if you haven't seen Lightswitch before, you will find that a Hello World in Lightswitch is a whole lot more than a dialogue with a button on it. So let's go ahead and get started. In the base product, you only have these two options, a Lightswitch application with Visual Basic or C#. When we make the HTML version available or the add-on available, you'll see these other two project types show up as well. That's just bringing in the HTML piece. We can do Visual Basic, we can do C#, doesn't matter. I'm going to do Visual Basic later, so let's go ahead and do C# this time. Let's call this Tech Ed Demo. Okay, so we'll say go. Lightswitch is going to go out and it's going to create the base project for me. Now, when I think about business applications, just maybe a little bit more about myself. So prior to my coming to Microsoft, I spent a lot of time, almost 10 years, doing custom software development with a couple small to mid-sized consulting companies in the Chicago, Illinois area. So I spent about 10 years building business applications using Microsoft tools, using non-Microsoft tools, Microsoft databases, non-Microsoft databases, all that kind of stuff. So spent a lot of time in there, and one of the things that I found in every project we did, these business applications really consist of three things: data, UI, and then the logic that is the business application, right? Your custom rules and things that you want to codify as part of that app. Now, I was a consultant, so people were paying me to build the software. And the thing they were really paying me to do was the third one, right? That's why they needed a custom app. They were paying me to write that custom logic. So when I sat down, 4 years ago now, and started thinking about the idea of something like Lightswitch, that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to create an experience where you spent the vast majority of your time as a developer focused on the things that were truly unique to that app, focusing on those rules, right? And looked at the stuff that in reality is more boilerplate, right? You just sort of rinse and repeat the way you do it, and just see, can we implement that on your behalf with just you providing us information about what your intent was, right? And then looking at what are the best practice architectures, frameworks, design patterns that we can implement that on top of. My team is a tooling team. We build Visual Studio. I don't like building frameworks and runtimes. We have other parts of the Microsoft organization that are really good at that. So I like to borrow their stuff and make it do cool new things. So that's the way we think about it. So the experience we create here is driven around that. The first thing you'll see is we'll ask you, what's the data you want to work with? And we have two options. We can create new data as part of the application. We can define new data structures. Or we can take advantage of existing data that's available to us within our organization. And of course, we can do both, and I'm going to show you that. So let's start doing Hello World. Let's start by creating a new table. We have a simple table designer here. Let's do something for like maybe a person. And you'll see that when we define these things, we're trying to go and follow a set of not only best practices in terms of what we implement, but also just conventions that we see very common in these business applications. So if you notice, when I called it person, we make an attempt to pluralize the collection version of that over in your Solution Explorer, right? Are we perfect? No, we're not perfect. But I was very confident that if what we did was, say, table one and table ones, we were going to always be wrong. So we make a best effort at it. You can change it. You can override it. It's all in your control. Let's just define what our person looks like. We'll say they have a name. That's a string. Let's say they have an email address. And one of the things we did to try to make this productive was we realized that in business applications, there's data types that are really common, right? But they're actually stored as some base data type, right? So like, let's take email address, for example. When you put that into a database table, you're going to store it as a string, right? But if you know it's an email address, we can suddenly start putting additional logic around it on your behalf. We can do things with the display. We can do rules and validation logic around it. We can do all those kind of neat things by just saying, oh, this is actually an email address. This is an extensible part of the product. The product is actually very extensible. You can define your own business types and add them into the Lightswitch environment. So if you have something like an account number that is very special to your organization, has special rules and display on it, you can define a light switch account number business type, make it available to all your developers. Now they can pick that, and you know they're going to consistently have UI and look and feel and rules for that account type. Okay, so we got an email address. We can specify and surface, you know, default or special properties based on the data type. So in this case, for my email, I have the ability to specify a default domain. So for me, I'll say it's Microsoft.com. If someone didn't put in a domain, we'll just default it. We can do something like, you know, let's have a photo, because everybody loves photos. As you'd expect, we have an image. We'll make that optional. Let's do cell phone, too. Why not? Just so you can see that we have this phone number type as well. This one's particularly interesting. It just shows you a little, kind of how far you can go. So for this one, we decided that patterns, right? What are the formats that you want to accept for phone number? We ship this set in the box. You can create your own. You can remove them. You can reorder them. So if I, you know, I said maybe I have a phone number that really is only 3 digits somehow. Well, we could add that as a valid pattern. And if I entered, you know, we would see in this little UI, right? We can even test our patterns and see which ones are going to be picked up and so forth. So let's just delete that because I don't know of any 3-digit phone numbers. Okay, so we've got a simple table. Next thing we need to do is we need to create UI. So I'm going to go over here. I'm going to add a screen. This is also where we took a look at the applications that were out there in this space, and we said, wow, you know what? As developers in business app world, we implement the same kind of UI over and over and over again. Why don't we drive the developer experience based on those common UI patterns? So you don't have to go blank screen and start drawing all this stuff out. We'll start with these patterns that are very common. Again, extensible part of the product. If you have UI patterns that you like to implement, you can define these templates, add them in, and just work with it. So in our case, what we'll do is we'll do a search screen, very common for people to find a record and then drill into it and work with it. So that's what this pattern does. So we'll go and say, you know, let's do search people. Again, try to default the name, try to be a little bit smart. Not going to be 100% right all the time, but screen one, usually wrong. So we'll say, let's create a search screen. I don't have any data yet, so let me add one more screen. We'll add a new data screen. And again, we'll go after our person here. Okay, so now we've got a simple table and 2 pieces of UI. So I'm going to go ahead and F5 this, and we'll see what we've got. Under the covers, what we are doing at this point is we've gone and we've created a database table, in this case, with one table called person. In the 2012 environment, we're actually using the new LocalDB instance of SQL Server, which is very lightweight. That's what we're using just sort of at developer time to give you a database behind this. We've created an entity framework model on top of that database so that you can use that to talk to the database. We've created a service tier in front of that entity framework model that will expose our data to the client, and it also will be the place where we will be able to put our custom business rules and logic that run on the server. And then we've created a Silverlight desktop application. In this case, it's a Silverlight out-of-browser application. That is our UI. And you see that with the Visual Studio Light Switch 2012 edition, we have a new default theme and skin here that looks a little bit more modern, a little bit less like the Frankenstein combination of OneNote and Outlook that we had in the first version. And now I can go and I've got, you know, navigation and so forth. So I can go in, I can say, you know, create a person. Maybe we'll create me. You know, I'll type part of my email address, tab off. You see that that's defaulted in the rest of the domain. Go ahead and pick a picture. And then, you know, if I do a cell phone thing, you know, I could say, you know, 206-555-1212. When I tab off, if it's valid, you see the format got applied to it. This also just shows you in the UI space with these business types, you can actually add additional UI editors, right, for that type, so we break apart all the pieces, right? If I had done not, let's say I hadn't specified the name, and I try to save this, you're going to see a validation rule has kicked in right away and said, hey, this is required. If I click on it, you see it's required. So I'll put that back in and move off of it, and our error has gone away. So we'll save that. We now have a record in the database. Let's go add one more person. So we have 2 people to work with. How about we pick on Beth? Those of you that are Light Switch people probably know Beth or know of Beth. If you have never seen her, that's Beth. So now we have right, two people. If I go back over here, I can close these windows. I can leave them open. I'll refresh this. We'll see that we're now, you know, reading and writing data from our database against our table using our service and all that kind of stuff. And we haven't had to go in and write any code yet because there's really nothing unique yet that we've done. A couple of things I'll point out. You'll notice on the bottom, we are trying to follow as many best practices as possible. So we do paging by default. We won't go do select star and bring everything back from the database. We will implement it via pages. You can control how big the pages are, whether we do that or not. You know, common functionality of business apps, the ability to search, right? So if I type BE and search, we see we've narrowed down to Beth. If I type micro and search, you'll see that we've got both of us because it found it in the email address. Again, we try to set some good defaults so that things work. For example, search, we will search across string values that we see. It's just a checkbox. You turn it on and off. If you do, there's fields you don't want to search on, just turn them off, and I'll show you that in a second. All those kind of great things are in your control. You'll also see I have this little export to Excel option here. I don't actually have Excel, unfortunately, on this machine, but if I click this, we will take whatever's in a grid, we'll copy that into Excel, and now the user can go work with it. Common request we've heard people have for these apps. I clicked it, and I don't have Excel. So, okay, we'll close, and now you see that's kind of the basic hello world. Yes? Good question. So the question was, he noticed how with the image, we actually implement the ability to go pick an image and upload it and store it and those kind of things. Can we do that for other data types as well? We are looking at it. We don't have it in there yet, but one of the things we are looking at, especially around our SharePoint support, would be the idea of maybe an attachment that is just any old file. So we can do it against SharePoint and stuff like that, but we could also just do it in general. That's a great request. Okay, so we've gone and we've seen the simple thing. Let's start moving a little faster here. One of the things that we do see often is it's not always just one source of data that you want in your application. Sometimes you're pulling data from multiple places and you kind of need to mash that up as part of your app. So we allow you to do multiple data sources inside of an application. We can connect to or attach to multiple types of data. You see that we have databases. This is anything that you have an entity framework provider for. SharePoint, we can talk to SharePoint lists, document libraries, those kind of things. WCF RIA services we did before. And in Visual Studio 2012, we've added the ability to attach to an OData source. If you're not familiar with OData, it's a very kind of open protocol for exchanging data, very restful, pretty straightforward to work with across a lot of different platforms. So when we do that, we just come in here and we can specify the location of our feed. If you haven't actually seen it, this is sort of what OData starts to look like. So what I've got here is an OData feed from Netflix. Figured it'd be kind of fun to play with Netflix data. And we can go in and I'll just show you, like if I drill into titles here, we'll start getting back a bunch of data from Netflix's catalog about the various titles they have available. And it's all just in XML and we can kind of scroll through and look at it and do all kinds of fun stuff. What I'm going to do though is just grab the front part of this, this URL. I'm going to copy that. We'll come over here and we'll paste it into our wizard. We can do read-write against these as well. Or we can just make them read-only. I'll just keep it read-only. If it's a secured feed, you can specify the auth credentials you need. In this case, the OData one's pretty wide open. I mean, the Netflix one. And then we see, based on the credentials we logged in with, these are all the entities we get. You get the same experience whether you're going against database, OData, SharePoint, RIA service. This experience is all very consistent and similar. We can go in and we can pull in whatever we want. Let's just pull in everything. This is sort of a point-in-time thing. There are pieces of OData that we don't understand yet, and so we'll tell you that there's something that we don't understand, and we'll just sort of ignore it as we attach to it. Then what comes in is we get the various entities get created for us. If I drill into something more interesting like titles, you'll see that we'll pick up whatever relationships to the other entities are in there and defined in a feed, and we can use them. What's also cool is I can go through here, and using this designer, I can look at these various things, and I can still take advantage of those business types even against an attached data source. So for example, we have a URL here, and one of the business types that we introduced is something called a web address. So I can tell Lightswitch that URL really is a web address. And now by default, when we present it, we'll present it as a hyperlink that will shell out to an Internet Explorer or your default browser instance when someone clicks on it. We can go, you know, if we We try to pick things up as best we can, so, you know, date times, all that kind of stuff. You know, here's a few more web addresses that we can maybe put in there. You know, tiny URL looks like it's probably a web address. Those kind of things. And then all the other relationships. I mentioned that we can decide what's searchable and what isn't. So you notice that we have display by default. We have a is searchable option over here. So I could decide that I just want to search on name. Let's not let people search on some of these other more verbose things like synopsis, which is sort of the description. What other strings do we have in here? Well, let's not even search on web address. That might be, oops, integer. Sorry. Turn that off. That one. Let's turn this one off. Let's see if there's any others in here that I want to get off. Rating. Oops. Keep that off. Type. Anyway, you get the idea, right? We'll just do a couple more of these, and then we'll go. Bye and bye. Okay. So we've pulled that in. Just like we did with the data we were creating, we can go in. We can go into our client. We can add a screen. Let's just do a simple search screen, and we will browse the Netflix titles. Say OK. And that's now going to add that to our app. When I run this, we'll see by default our people screen or person screen will come up. But in our navigation menu up here, come on, we have the ability to also kind of search the titles. And we see this is coming up as well. You know, these applications, because it's Silverlight based, in this case, it's all async, right? So you notice that even when we're loading data from one screen, I can still interact with the other rest of the app. So all those things you just kind of get for free. So here you see all of my data from Netflix. You see it's being paged, right? I've got about, you know, at least 5 pages worth of data coming back. Cool thing that you get to do with Lightswitch, because it's the pattern-based thing, we know that you want to go and make some additional modifications to that. And what better way to do that than when you actually have the data available to you? So as the developer, when I'm running under the debugger, I can take the app, take a screen, and put it into a design mode. And now I can do things like decide that, you know, maybe things like the synopsis just are not going to be good to show in a grid, so let's delete those. If you watch, let me make this a little bit bigger for you. Come on. So you can see it. When I go and I say delete, that column's just going to go away. Right? I can do the same thing for short synopsis. Maybe that URL is something that I do think is interesting, so let's move that a little bit further up. And you see as I'm bumping it up, it's just moving in the order in the column. I can do resizing logic now, too, so I can decide that, okay, let's make it a little bit bigger. Let's make that a little bit bigger. And I got the richness of the data there to help me figure out, am I making these things bigger or smaller, or are these changes going to work with my actual data? When I'm happy with the changes, I can just click Save. It's going to take me right back into the application, reload that screen I was working on, save the changes back into my project for me, and we're off and running. So kind of a cool thing to help you tweak and modify. The only thing we won't do in that preview is run your code. So we'll disable any commands you put on the UI, just so we don't get into trouble and have crashes and bad things happening. Okay, so created data, consumed data. Now I want to relate the data, right? So let's make it possible for our people to have favorites. So let's add a new table. We'll call it favorite. And there's nothing else I need to really do here, so let's just go create these relationships. We want to create a relationship between the favorite and the person. So favorite and person. You see down here, you know, we're trying to give a little bit of English as to, okay, a favorite must have a person. People can have many favorites. Typical one-to-many kind of relationship. That sounds great. Let's add another relationship. Go from favorite to title. So now we're doing a relationship across data sources. And again, favorite must have a title, title can have many favorites, sounds good. We're going to auto-generate the value on this new table and use one that's on the other side. We can pick whatever we needed to. The ID works. And you see we now have that relationship drawn as well. To get this on a piece of UI, you notice that when I clicked on a person or when I created a person, we saw this sort of default details screen, right? Just sort of auto-generated. Well, we can create our own. So let's go in, add a screen, add a details screen. We'll choose person. And you see that we're picking up all the relationships of person, so we can bring in person and their favorites, right? Add that into the UI. And if I run this, what you'll see is that now when I drill into somebody, we're going to have the detail about them, but then we'll also have a grid below with their favorites. Now, of course, in this case, it's going to be empty because we don't have any favorites yet. But just to show you what it kind of looks like. Okay, let's go drill into me maybe. And you can tell that now we've laid this thing out differently. We can fix it different. And then we have the ability to go and add these things. This grid is editable, so I can go in and I can start adding titles that are my favorites and saving them in. But that UI is kind of nasty. So let me show you a trick for how to make it look a little bit better. A couple things we might want to do. We may want to go and actually create a sort order for things and that kind of stuff. But instead, what we'll do is let me just go in here and say, for an individual favorite, rather than showing the summary of it, let's actually give you the ability to do a modal kind of window, right? So we can go in here and say, okay, actually, that's not what I want to do. Control it. Let's go for the title. And rather than that autocomplete box, let's do a picker, right? So by default, it had a little drop down that was doing the autocomplete, and we do a type ahead for you. But let's actually have it be a picker window. So we have a picker window. We can go in. We can specify what we want to have show up in that picker window. And you'll see that, you know, in this case, we just have the title. We can go and decide that actually, you know what's going to be better is make it easier for you to pick things, is we can use these layout styles that we add in addition to the templates. So what we can do here is we can say that rather than just a summary, single line of text, let's do something that's a little bit more visual and has a little more data. So we have this, we call it a picture and text layout, and then we just specify some styles and you map the data to it. So in our case, we're going to say the title should be the name, the subtitle, let's make that the release year, and then the description, how about we do the short synopsis for that, right? And so that's going to go and lay that out for me. And now, when I F5 this and run it, what will happen is when I go to try to add something in that dropdown, rather than having a dropdown with an autocomplete, I'll actually have the ability to go into a modal picker and I get a richer view of what these things are. So if I go in here, I say, choose me, I go add something, and if I didn't have a bug in the release candidate, you would see the ability for me to go pop up this modal picker that I can go pick from and go drop back in. But unfortunately, I have a bug in the release candidate, so it didn't pick up that change. I apologize for that. But you get the idea. I wanted to go ahead and walk through it anyway so you kind of saw the flow of what you could do. So that's the basics of getting a Lightswitch app up and running. You saw how we can consume OData. You saw how we can go do relationships across things and so forth. The other thing that Lightswitch has done in Visual Studio 2012 is we've actually changed our underlying service protocol from using WCF RIA services to just using OData ourselves as well. What that means, let me go make one change here just to show you this. Let's change application type to web and run it again. What that means now is that all of your services that you created are now being exposed via OData as well. So it makes it really easy for someone to come up to your service and build another kind of application or use another kind of application to interact with that data from yours. But it's your service, which means that all of your rules, all of your authentication logic that I'll show you in a minute, all get applied. Right? So if you lock it down, then they're going to not be able to access it. If you make it open, they can access it. All right. Cool. That's awesome. Okay, the reason I switched it to this browser instance is it makes it a little bit easier for me to grab the URL. So if I go in here, paste that, and then we just use a naming convention for these services, and we base it on the actual data source name. So if I say application data.svc, which is the default creation one, you see that there's my OData feed. And if I go in here and say people, you should see a record come back for me and for Beth. Right, so just exposing it via OData, making it easier for people to use. Yeah. Great question. So the question was, where do we put the connection string for the data and stuff like that? Hold that thought. I'll show it to you a little bit later when we get into the deployment piece. It's a good question, though. Okay, so let's close that. So that's Hello World. I promised we'd get into some deeper stuff, so we're going to do that right now. We're going to fast forward into some more kind of real stuff that you want to go do. So I'm going to go ahead and we'll just minimize it. My machine seems to be working okay. So here is the basic application that Jason had started with in his keynote that is our Contoso Moving Scheduling app. And I said, I removed a bunch of stuff. So what you'll see is, you know, we can search customers. We can, you know, look at appointments. We can search appointments. We can create appointments. All of those kind of fun things. what I want to do is, the first thing I want to do is I want to create sort of a home screen for the application. So what I want is, when the app launches, I want people to actually just first see a list of appointments, and then we want to put some commands on there to make it really quick and easy for them to go create an appointment or maybe create a new customer. Right? So they don't have to go through the menu structure. We'll just start them with a home screen. So let me close that. Let's start building that part of the application. You notice we have dirty checking by default, so you won't have that bug that was in a lot of my apps when I first started building business apps, where I forgot to check and prompt for saves. We take care of that for you. Okay, so let's go create that screen. So I'm going to go in here, right-click, add screen. We will do a search screen. Let's go search for appointments. Rather than using the default name, let's go call this home. All right, so we'll give it a new name. Now we're going to see we're going to have this home screen added. I apologize for this Server Explorer bug, too. That is extremely annoying and will be fixed very quickly. Let me go into the properties of the client application. And we'll go into our screen navigation. And what I'm going to do is take that home screen and set it to be the default. And maybe since it's default, why don't we also bump it up in the menu structure? So you see, this is how we control what the navigation looks like in the application. So if I run this, what we're going to see is that rather than the customer screen come up, we'll see a list of appointments come up. And ta-da, there's our home screen. And here's just a dump of appointments that we have set up in the database. The other thing I said I wanted to do was add a couple commands that allow you to kind of quick launch into creating a customer or creating an appointment. So we'll go back into our home screen designer. And up here at the screen command node, where we have the save and refresh, we will just add two buttons. So we'll add one. We'll call it new appointment. New appointment. And we'll add one more and call that one new customer. Okay, now in the Silverlight version, we need to write a little bit of code to actually make those that implement the logic of the button. So we'll go over here and we'll edit the execute method. And we'll just write our code to go pop open or launch the create appointment screen. So in this case, we're just going to go in here and we say application.show create new appointment. Now, new appointment takes an optional or nullable parameter that is the customer. So if we wanted to go from an existing customer, create appointment for them, we could know how to default that in. In our case, we're coming from the home screen, so we don't know who the customer is. So we're just going to pass in nothing, basically null, right? Let's go back to our designer. Do the same thing here. So we'll add the code for creating a new customer. And as you expect, application.show new customer screen. This one has no parameters, so we don't need to pass anything to it. We'll run it. And now we should see that on the bottom, I'm going to have two new buttons. You're going to see I just have a default button image in there. We can change that if we want. You can put your own images in there. I won't bother doing that because you guys all know how to use a property grid to do things like that. So we'll go in and say, let's create a new appointment. We'll pick a customer. And you notice that the address already defaulted for the customer. So I had some logic that I'd written previously that does that. I'll show you how to do that because, boy, wouldn't it also be nice if, say, we defaulted the start time to maybe tomorrow might make sense, or also defaulting the end time maybe to be, let's say our appointments are typically 2 hours, so we could default the end time from 2 hours from the start time, right? So I'll show you how to do that in the same logic that we used for the customer. But anyway, at this point, we can choose an employee, we can choose a move type. The other thing that maybe we want to do is, maybe we have some standard templates for the layout or the configuration of certain types of moves. So, you know, let's say if we know we're going to a residential home, maybe we say, yeah, we have a kitchen, a living room, a family room, two bedrooms, right? If it's an apartment, maybe it's one bedroom and no basement or, you know, those kinds of things. We'd love to just get some of those room types in there by default for them so that our user doesn't have to do that. So let's implement that logic now in the application. We'll say, okay, we don't need to save that yet. So to do that, we're going to interact with a different kind of code. I should have said this beforehand. With Lightswitch, there's really three types of code you write. You write server business rules, right? You write validation rules that you actually want to execute in both places, and then you write screen code, right? In all cases, in this version, you're just writing .NET code. Server code, full .NET framework code, client code, Silverlight code, the stuff that runs in both. If you've heard of the transparent assemblies, those subset of the CLR that can execute the same binary in Silverlight as it can in the desktop or the full server framework, that's what we restrict you to, so we can send that binary back and forth. You don't have to think about that, though, when you're building this app, because we just sort of guide you into the correct place based on the entry point you went to code from. So what we want to do is we want to go into our appointments entity, and when I drop down the right code, you'll see the basic places that I can write code. Here's the general things around appointment. So what I want to do is I want to go implement appointment created, and this is where I can go and default the start date to maybe tomorrow. So all we're going to do is we're going to come in here, and we're going to say that, let's maybe default the move type to something like, residential. We can do the start date equals to, how about we just do something like today.addDays. We'll just add a day to that. And then we'll say the end date equals the start date, and we'll just add maybe 2 hours to that, right? Does that make sense? So we defaulted the move type, we defaulted the start date, and we defaulted the end date. Well, that's probably not the right start time. They're probably going to choose that. So why don't we go in here and also implement some logic so that when the start date is changed, we can update the end date to be an appropriate default. So we'll go into start date changed, and you guessed it. What we're going to do is we're just going to say end date equals start date, add hours, 2. So now when I change the time on the start, we'll default the time on the end to be appropriate. Last thing I said I wanted to do was when someone specifies the type of move, I want to default the room configuration. Just give them a base template to start with. So same thing. When move type changed, we'll go in and we'll write some logic to do that. So we can just do something like, say, if rooms.count is less than 1, so we'll just say, okay, if there's no rooms defined already, then we'll dump in the defaults. So we'll just do like a select case move type, and we'll say case. You see I've defined some move type values down here, so we'll like move type values dot residential. And then we'll just write a little bit of code to interact with the rooms. So we'll say with rooms, do a dot add. We need to create a new room, so we'll say new room. With, take advantage of all that cool, instantiation logic and stuff like that that the language teams have built over the last few versions. So we can just default the name. We'll say that, I happen to have a room type values enumeration as well. So we'll say, we want to have a living room in there by default, right? So that's the way we would do that, right? Now, you guys, just take a couple minutes. I'm going to go ahead and write the rest of this code. Just kidding. The feature that I'm still trying to figure out how to implement for everybody is the fact that the toolbox would just have all the code that you intended to write already there available for you. That would be cool. That would be a cool feature, right? Okay, so you see that what we've got here is one little issue. Let's get that out of there. So all this is, it's the same pattern that you saw me do. So we're adding a bunch of rooms for each certain type. So let's just go ahead and run this. And see where we're at. Okay, so our appointment list will come up. Create a new appointment. See that it's defaulted to tomorrow, right? Let's go set the time. Let's say maybe what we want to do is do 9 a.m. And you see that it's now switched to 11. Right, as the end date, we'll grab a customer, defaulting that, we'll grab an employee, let's assign this into me, let's grab a move type, let's do residential home, and you see, boom, we've just populated all that sort of default template, click save, and we've now saved our new appointment. So pretty straightforward approach. I think one of the things that we, is nice about this is we try to implement this pattern, so there's a pretty good convention of where you should be writing code to interact with these things. And when we went back and looked at the entity, for example, you'll see that all the places that I can interact with this stuff, right? So the way to think about it is, if data is coming in or going in or coming out of that database, you can interact before or after it happened, right? So inserting, inserted, updating, updated, right? That's the pattern we implement for all of these things. At the individual property level, you can go do change events. We also have this pattern for doing some levels of authentication that I'll show you in a bit, as well as just a general validate, right? So if you want to go do some appointment level validation, you can do that. If you want to do field level validation, you can do that, and we will make sure that validate gets called at the right time, so you don't have to go deal with that text changed, you know, kind of crazy event loops that we used to get into. I never did that myself, but that was a joke. I did it a lot. Okay, so we've seen how we can go programmatically bring up screens, see how we can do some defaulting logic when we're creating and updating values to get a nice user experience there. Next thing I want to do is we're showing just a full list of appointments. That's not all that helpful, right? How about if we go and tailor this a little bit more and actually just show maybe the appointments that are in the future, like today or later, as well as maybe only show a few, like let's just show 15 of them, maybe as an example. Well, to do that, we'll go create a query. So in addition to just the general things, we can create our own queries. So I can add a query here. We'll call it, you know, upcoming appointments. I did it off of appointments, so that's my source. And, you know, maybe we'll sort this by the start date, ascending. So that's going to give me now a sorted result set of appointments based on their start date. Well, what if I only want some? So I said I only want to take like 15 of them. All right. Our query modeler doesn't go that deep yet. But that's okay, because we can write additional query code. So I can just go in here and say, let's write some additional query code. And now we'll compose the designed part of the query with whatever you write in here in code. And now we're just going to write a link query. So what we're going to do is we'll say query equals from APT in query. We can filter it. We said we wanted to maybe look at after today. So what we'll do is say where start date, start. Come on, tell us start date. Oh, sorry, appt.startDate is greater than or equal to today, right? That's going to give us the ones in the future. We won't get any from the past anymore. And then we can use the take operation and say, let's just take the top 15, right? So that's now composed that. We'll have a sorted thing based on that. Let's go into our home screen. And what I can do here is I can go and add a data item to the screen. We can add a different query. And when we scroll through here, we should see our upcoming appointments query is available. So we'll add that in. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to nuke the grid I have and pull out a new one. And if I wanted to, I can go in here. I can delete the original appointments, too, so we don't need those anymore. For those of you that aren't familiar with Lightswitch and this designer can get a little bit, takes a little getting used to. The way to think about it, the stuff over here, this is your view model. We use a view model pattern for the UI. So this is your view model. This is just sort of the layout and the content tree of what you're using inside your template. So you think about the designer as what's the data I want to be in the template, what commands do I want to be available, and you just kind of go from there. Any little tweaking, you can do it here, or you can do it in the runtime designer. Okay, if I run this, and assuming I did that correctly, what we should see now is just 15 appointments come back. And we've got about 15 appointments came back, right? All of which should be scheduled for today or later. Cool? All right. Let's go a little farther than that. One of the things that is common in these applications is the, I'm going to avoid the security word, because that's really not what I was going for when we designed this. It was really more around, you have an application, and for these apps, let's say 80% of the people that are using the app can use, well, let's put it this way, reverse that. 20% of the people can use all functionality of the app, and 80% of the people, maybe there's one area that they're not allowed to get to. And so you want the ability to, based on who the user is, sort of tailor that app a little bit and maybe have functionality appear or disappear. Maybe we also want to do some things based on retrieving data based on who the user is. So, boy, it'd be really helpful if when I logged into my app, rather than seeing the next 15 appointments for the company, I saw my next 15 appointments, right? So what we'll do is we'll start working with the authentication system that we have inside of LightSwitch. So I'll go into the properties here, and right now we have no authentication turned on, so we'll turn on Windows authentication. One of the new things we did in Visual Studio 2012 with LightSwitch was add better Active Directory group support, so you can just do Active Directory groups as far as the auth thing, or individual users, or we can allow anybody that can log in. The concept here is if you can log into the machine, you can run the app, right? If you can't log into the machine, then you can't run the app. So we'll just use that level here. Okay, so we've got that set. Let's go create a new query that will actually go and bring appointments for me that are upcoming. So we'll say, what do we want to call it? How about upcoming? All right, let's just appointments for current user. And now I can base that on appointments, but I also already have a query, right, that uses appointments and only grabs me 15. I'd like to reuse that. So I can base this query on that other query. Make sense? So I can start composing queries on top of each other. A little bit more advanced technique, but you can do it that way, or you can just write against the other source, whichever you want to do. So I don't need to add a sort here, because it's already going to be sorted when it comes to me. What I want to do is add some code to filter it down by the current user. Again, not something I can model, so no problem. We know we can just drop into code. Let's go ahead in there and say query equals, from appt in query, where appt dot employee dot name dot username equals application dot user dot name. Now, because I worked with this on the other query, actually I did it backwards. My bad. Let's do something different. We're going to fix this. This isn't going to work as well as I wanted it to. We'll do something. We'll make it a little bit cooler. So let's do appointments for current user. Let's make this one go against appointments and do, and let's go to our upcoming appointments and have it work on appointments for current user. That way I don't have to go change the screen again, right? So now, if I did all this correctly and if my data is set up correctly, we should see only the appointments that are assigned to me as the employee. Now, the reason I'm saying if my data is set up correctly is I can't remember which user ID I did, and I did some quick edits to my data before you guys came in. And I did it wrong. So what we'll do is go to employees. Actually, let's go to just all appointments. There is a way, by the way, that you can filter all of these things as well. Let's scroll over to the employee, J. Schmelzer, J. Let's go look at employees real quick. Search for employees. There's me, edit me. I think what we're actually going to need to do is try this. Let's just see what happens. If this fails, then we'll bail. Yeah, all right, you have to trust me on that one. In all honesty, what it is I'm in running Win8, as you can see, and I'm running logged in with my live ID. If we have time at the end, we'll actually debug through it, but I don't want to do debugging in front of you guys. I would like to, but you don't want to see it. So, okay. But that's the way that works, right? That's just a data problem. Okay, so we've seen how we can go and work with sort of authentication in terms of query. But I said one of the things that we wanted to do there was control what you can do in the application based on who you are, right? So let's go back to our properties for our server. And you may notice I have this little grid down here. The way we decided to do this was rather than making you write code that is kind of along the lines of is member or is in role or is group, right? What we decided instead was let's let you as a developer define tokens that are the thing you want to check for. And then user and groups to permissions, that's just an administrative feature of the application, right? The number of times that I implemented it the other way and there was a reorg and suddenly, managers could start scheduling appointments now. Crap, I'm checking for the, scheduler role, not the manager role. I got to go change code to fix that app. That's not cool. It'd be better if they just said, the manager role now has the can schedule appointment permission, and my code never changes. So that's the way we approach this. So let's just do a, can create appointment kind of token. You can give it more descriptions and that kind of stuff, which will show up in the UI of the app when you're administering it. Now, what I want to do is I want to come in here, and let's go into our appointments entity, and we'll start locking this down from the back forward. So the only thing I really have to do to implement this is go in and leverage this pattern that we created. You see I have a can insert method off of appointment. And now all I gotta do is just type a line of code that says, result equals application.user.hasPermission can create appointment. Right? So that'll return true if I have the permission, false if I don't. In this case, I don't have the permission, so let me run it. Now I said this is all we have to do to secure the back end. You're gonna see this is still not a great user experience yet because I'm gonna trick the user into thinking they can do something they can't, and I'm gonna tell them way at the end that they can't. So I can go in, I can still click the new create new appointment button, and I can start creating a new appointment. So I can go through all this work of scheduling an appointment and assigning it to me and doing all this fun stuff, only to find out you don't have permission to do it. Well, that's kind of a bummer, right? So we got you. We got you covered. We thought about that. So what I can do now is I can go at the screen at the next level of detail. So let's start with the screen. We have a create new appointment screen. When I bring this up and I look at the code, what you'll see is I have a method, can run. I can go into can run and I can just do, result equals application.current.user has permission, can create appointment. You might ask yourself, why is the pattern different between the two? You would be asking yourself a very good question. You would then run into, and I change it now, and I broke code. So that's an unfortunate design flaw we had in the first version. So the patterns are a little different, but hopefully they're understandable. So this button's still there. But if I go to appointment, notice I don't have a create appointment menu option anymore, right? The default shell is smart enough to call that can run method for any screen that you've implemented it for, and get the result back. And if you can't run it, then we just take the menu away. So we don't even tease you with the fact that it's there. All right, we still have that button. You guessed it. All we got to do is go into our home screen, take our new appointment button, right click, edit the can execute code. Am I the only person that sees these comments that say write code here and kind of get a little offended by them? Yeah, there's some feedback from my team that's coming back on that one. Comments should be helpful. That's probably not a helpful. All right, now when I bring it up, what we'll see is we took a different pattern, and you can control this a little bit within the default shell. You can also create your own shell and your own theme, in which case you have total control of how this thing is laid out and how these things behave. What did I do? Oh, thank you. That's what happens when you talk and type. Okay, so when I run it this time, you see we took a different approach for buttons, for commands, and we don't remove it, we just disable it. So there we are, disabled. Now our customer would never get mad at us because they started going and creating an appointment only to find out they couldn't. And now, because we implemented this way, right, going back to that OData thing, if I tried to go and use the OData service to create an appointment, if I didn't have permission, we'd still get blocked in the service, right? So even if somebody built another app and didn't know about these permissions and didn't do as good a job as we did of stopping the user from trying to do it, we'd still prevent them from hitting it on the back end, right? So following that good multi-tier design pattern, the idea that it's a service, you created it for your client, but doesn't mean it's the only client that's ever going to use it. So we wanted to make sure that those rules are consistently applied there. Okay, so that's a little bit about the authentication stuff. Let's get into deployment. So made you wait for a long time, but the question was, how do I deal with connection strings and all that kind of stuff? Well, let's go in here. And when we're all done and happy with our app, we can right-click and we can say publish. And now what this wizard's going to do is going to walk me through a set of steps for actually deploying my application. With the Silverlight client, we have the option of deploying it as an out-of-browser desktop app, which means it has a little bit more access to the machine. We can do things like launch, other applications, talk via comm to things. We could deploy it as a web-based app, in which case it's now the same Silverlight app, it's just inside the browser, right, and living in that sandbox. So things like export to Excel don't work because you can't call a comm and things like that. New in this version is the ability to just create the service. So let's say you don't want our client application that's created with Lightswitch. You want to create maybe a native Windows Phone app or a native WinRT app. Okay, fine. You can still use Lightswitch to create a data service for you. Just say, publish only the data service, and we won't push the client up with it at all. You'll still have the client in your project. I kind of think of it as the easiest test client you'll ever create, right? To go and execute your service, but that's why we put that in there. Okay. Next thing we do is we ask you, okay, how do you want to deploy that middle tier? Remember, we're creating a multi-tier application on your behalf. If I did the desktop thing, we give you this top option, lights up, in which case what we will do is collapse that server tier, that service tier, down into the client, and now you have the old traditional two-tier desktop app. Okay. When you do a web app, you obviously can't do that. We need a web server. And we now, once we know we have a web server, we know we have an app a server that could be an app server, so we do it that way. So then we have IIS, or of course we have Azure. This is just telling me that currently we don't do Windows Auth against Azure. We will probably take that forced change out of there so that if you want to do the configuration to do Azure Active Directory stuff that you've probably heard about this week, you can. And then we'll work towards getting it better for you. But so, you know, I can do Azure, I can do IIS. Let's go to Azure. You'll see that the experience, if you've done Azure Development Visual Studio, we've finally got the two things in sync as far as the experience, as close as we can. Good thing, since it's my team doing both of them, it was a little weird that I did it two different ways. So that whole published settings file is still something that exists. So if you have one, you go grab it. If you don't, you can just go out to the portal and log in. And log in as somebody different, because that one's not going to work. We'll log in as... So this is a place where we've federated between our Microsoft Active Directory and Azure. So that's why, because I'm not on my domain, you're seeing me log in this way. What we're going to do is now, in this case, the portal is going to go generate this published settings file for me that I can now save. We'll just save it down into my downloads directory. Okay, close that. Import that back in. What this file, this is just a little XML file that includes all the information that Visual Studio needs to connect up to your Azure subscription, so like the management cert and all that kind of stuff that you use it to go and copy around and subscription GUIDs and stuff like that. Don't need that anymore. We can now connect to the administration APIs of Azure. I can click Next. We're going to go out and we're going to query Azure right now and figure out what's available from my subscription. You see that I have a bunch of services out here. If I want to create a new one, we just go create a new, let's call it maybe LS Tech Ed. LS Tech Ed. We'll pick, how about US West? Say OK. And that's going to go create the hosted service for me. It's going to, should put it here in my list real quick, if I didn't have a bug. And then we pick the slot and all that kind of fun stuff. Advanced things, storage accounts, right? Visual Studio puts your app in storage and then activates it out of storage. So that's what we needed there. The next thing we'll do, we're getting there. I'm almost to your question. A few other things around administration. Do you want to create a user account for this? If so, what's that username? HTTPS, since your service in this case is out public, you probably want to do it over HTTPS and do those kind of things. So we can just go through and create those certs or apply them in. Finally, database connections. Okay. What we're asking you here is two questions. What connection do you want the app to use? What credentials do you want the application to use? So I could come in here and I could say, the app's going to use... Server's kind of irrelevant in the Azure case, but let's just say localhost. This would obviously not work if I deployed this, but right, so that's kind of like, this is the credentials that we want the app to use. And we could say, okay. The second one is, what credentials do you have to actually publish the database? So these would be like the DBA, DBO level credentials. Hopefully they're different. We don't make them be different, but we're just trying to encourage you, like maybe give you a quick thought of, they're asking me for two. Maybe I should have two kind of thing. So then you put this one in there. And you'd say, okay, if you, well, I don't want to make you guys, we'll try a different deployment. So this would go, and in the Azure case, what I'd go do is I'd go grab my credentials for SQL Azure, right, and dump them in here, and then we go off. We say next one more time, you know, it's going to show us what we did, and we can say publish, and we're going to go off and start creating the cloud service model for you. We will package that up. We will go talk to SQL Azure, deploy your database for you, get the, you know, get all the DDL scripts put together, execute them against your SQL Azure database, upload your package, and then boom, everything's up and running and beautiful. If we had multiple data sources, so if I'd gone and done this, actually I can, cancel. If I flip over to that first project we had, right, where we had two data sources, the Netflix one and our local one, we just skip to the data connections option. You see I have the database that I was creating, but I also have now have this additional data sources tab. This is just giving you one opportunity to change the connection strings for the thing you've attached to. Maybe when you're building your app, you're working against the development instance of it, right? And you have a different one for test and a different one for production. Those are all just sitting in config files, right, like any normal .NET app. And this is just giving you a way to get it packaged once the right way. It's one opportunity. It's still in a config file. You can always change it later, just like you would any of your other deployments. So that's sort of how we handle those kind of things. We're gonna go off-road in here a little bit. Because it's the last day of tech ed, why not, right? You guys will be nice. If this demo fails, you won't yell at me too bad about it. So I mentioned that when we do this, when I was talking about Azure, I was saying, hey, you know, the Azure one is what we call the cloud service model, right? The PaaS offering. Last Thursday, we started talking about this thing called Azure Websites, right? The high-density, shared sort of hosting kind of solution from Azure. Well, we support that too from Lightswitch. Now, we're going to smooth this out, so you don't have to know this black magic I'm about to show you. But, you know, when we finally release it under Windows Azure, you're letting it a choice. Did you want, you know, the PaaS model, or did you want the website model? The website model is just web deploy, right? And that's what we use for IIS deployments. So actually, it's worth walking you through this anyway. So let me walk you through this real quick, just show you what's in here. This is probably what you're going to do for your internal deployment, right? You're going to deploy to an IIS server you have somewhere. Again, we use the web deploy, the MS deploy technology under the covers. So we have two options. Do you have the ability to publish directly to that server? Do you have the credentials? If so, just give them to us and we'll do it. In a lot of environments, maybe you don't have those permissions, right? In which case, we'll just create an MS deploy package on disk that you can then hand to your administrator or whoever is managing those servers for you, and they can go install it. It's a straight, standard, everyday MS deploy package. Nothing special about it. You know, so which means they can go look at it and really make sure that it is what they expect, but that's just what it is. So we'll do all that kind of stuff. And then the rest of this is kind of the same, right? Some of the options are a little bit different. So like security-wise, we don't force you to do HTTPS. We don't even as strongly encourage you when it's an internal deployment because you're on your internal network, right? It's your call. Same thing for digital signatures and all those kind of fun things. What I wanted to do, though, was we added the import settings option. So just like we saw with the Azure PaaS stuff, IIS has the ability to do this publish settings file, which gives you all the information we need to hit the web deploy endpoint, like what are the credentials, what are the URLs, and all those kind of things. So let's go do a little off-road exercise here. And we'll go to windowsazure.com. I'll sign in again, which it should just do for me. I'll go to the new portal. Those of you that have been working with Azure before, hopefully you really enjoy this new portal as much as I do. It's so much nicer, so much easier to work with. So here you see just a big flat list of stuff. What I'll do is I'm going to go in here. I'm going to create a new website. And we'll just do a quick create. Create with database, actually. Let's do tech ed site demo. Let's create a new SQL database. We'll do it in the East region. We'll say next. It's asking me what size database. This is going to be fine for what I need. Go next. Choose a server. These are, so it's already found my existing SQL Azure subscriptions, right, or servers that I have. I have three, really obviously named. So we'll go choose this one. We'll specify our login credentials. And we'll specify my password. We'll say OK. Now it's going to go off and it's going to create this website for me. All right, we won't wait for it to create it. We'll come back over here to one I pre-did. And the thing that we have here is you notice I have this download publish settings file. So I click on this, save this one down to my machine, say OK, close that. Flip back over here to Visual Studio, import settings, downloads, Contoso Moving Azure website, open, next. Boom. All that information is filled in for me. Should just be able to say publish. Oops. Which one did I miss? Security settings. We'll say no, it's already there. Next. Defaulted all the database connection strings for me. Publish. And now we'll go off and publish this using Web Deploy to my Azure website. And this one should actually go a heck of a lot quicker than what the full PaaS service model one would do. Like, quick enough that we may actually see it finish here before I give up. Yeah, you want to go way off-road? We can go way off-road if you guys want. Lightswitch fully supports source control. So the other thing I could do, that's a great idea. We're gonna go off-road even further. If I can't break it enough now, we're going to really break this thing. What I could go do, once this thing stops and it gives me back access to Visual Studio, I can go connect up and put my Lightswitch project in my TFS preview, and then I can go through the whole continuous integration, continuous deployment hookup and authorize my TFS preview to be able to publish to my Azure website. And now whenever I check in, we'll do a build, we'll push to Azure for you, and you get this nice, cool continuous integration, continuous delivery flow. That whole story kind of plumbs together pretty nicely there. It looks like this publish is not going to... You know, it turns out that Azure website's really a popular thing. So a lot of folks are playing with that. Okay, so hopefully what you saw... I'll take that question real quick here in a second. But hopefully what you saw through this was a little bit of a hello world kind of how do we create tables, how do we go use OData, how do we do relationships across those. Saw a little bit of that screen design experience. We then went a little bit deeper. Let's say it's kind of hard to call that stuff I did advanced and feel like look at myself in the mirror the next day and feel good about it. But from a Lightswitch perspective, it is advanced, right? It's just showing you that, yeah, all this other stuff that you need to do, there's probably some straightforward ways to do it in Lightswitch. And then when you find something that's not there, it's just .NET. Ah, bummer. My deployment failed. It's just .NET code, right? So that's all cool. And that actually makes it, you know, straightforward, approachable. It's just the stuff you know how to do. Since not everybody saw it, I realized that I promised you guys I would do one more thing. Let me flip back over here. Let me get that message out of the way. Oop, you didn't see that. Go away. So it lets me do all the kind of rules, basic authentication, all that fun stuff that I might want to do. One of the things that I've been hearing a lot as I talk to folks is that, you know, the world of just having PCs that I manage and control seems to be going away. And I've got this, like, my CIO or CTO or vice president or pick your favorite exec has come into work with this really cool, slick tablet and says, I want my apps on this. And you go, crap. Well, what we wanted to do with Lightswitch was give you the ability to start creating companion applications for your existing desktop applications that work well on those devices. So with not in Visual Studio 2012 itself, this will come a little bit later, but we announced it in the keynote on Monday. It's coming soon. We've added the ability to now add an HTML client or just create from scratch, from the beginning, an HTML client to my application. So I can go in here and I can say, you know, I want a mobile client. This client, this thing is an HTML client. It is standards, HTML, JavaScript, CSS. So it will run on any modern browser and crash my machine. Oh, that so sucks. All right, that's not my fault. We went way off-roading, right? Now, let's try it again. That should just work. Let's see how far it got. It does not. It is standards HTML. You go away. You don't want. All right, we're running out of time, so here's what we're going to do. Close. Yeah, sure. Open VS. So for those of you that were at my demo before, I'm going to move to my finished version of it. The experience is the same. It's standards HTML. So it's HTML. It's JavaScript. Actually, if you really want to get geeky about it, it's jQuery Mobile. That's what we're using. We're using jQuery Mobile under the covers. So jQuery Mobile, jQuery work really well with it, which allows us to work on multiple devices. What I've done here is I've added this already, but let me just show you the experience. Just like you would expect, add screen, same templated experience, way early, right? Not done, a lot more coming here. Same experience though. By default, we hook you up to the existing service. It's already in your project in this case. I can pick all that same stuff. I could get appointments, all those kind of fun things. Let me run this and show you what we actually get from this. This one's been tweaked and customized. It's the end of my session the other day. So I've already got some custom CSS in here. I've got some custom, using some custom jQuery Mobile and jQuery controls to do some of this UI. But you see what I've got is a UI that does a pretty good job of flowing itself, right? So what we tried to do was do a good job of flow so that, you know, you got your tablet like this, and then they sort of turn it like this, and then they grab their phone, which makes it look like this, right? And we, you know, we want it to be functional, we want it to feel good. We designed it, our primary design point for the first time was the tablet size, right? That viewport size. So I'm not trying to say what I went out and did was create the right at once and it works beautifully everywhere. That's not what we're going for. We wanted it right at once, functional everywhere, right? So even if I go in and use this, you'll see that if we get a little bit deeper into this app, let's blow it all the way up. If I drill in, I have the ability to, you see I've got a Bing map integrated in here and all that kind of fun stuff. If I edit, you see that I've got this edit screen, right? This is just using that shadow box kind of, or light box thing. Notice that when I make it smaller, come here. Edit. When I made it smaller, right, it knows how to flow itself a little bit, right, and deal with the change in screen resolution size. And this is a bug in our layout that it didn't go back. Last thing I'll show you, to prove you that it is just HTML and JavaScript, all those tools that you may have seen if you're a web developer and you've seen us talking about this week around DOM explorers and F12 tools and all those cool things, they work here too, right? And that's actually probably the easiest way for me to show you that this is just standard CSS and JavaScript. Here's the DOM explorer. Let's go into selection mode. You know, you want to see where that came from? Boom, there it is, right? We're putting a lot of effort into making sure that the HTML that we generate from this client looks like human-readable HTML. It looks like HTML you would have written yourself if you did it on your own. Sure, maybe a div or two extra, right? Only to make our lives easier to find things, but not so much that you can't figure out what the heck's going on in that thing. So that's that last little bonus demo for you guys. So I think with that, you know, you'll see that we've now got the ability to go and build our apps for the desktop, you know, where I'm sitting down with a keyboard and mouse and doing data entry. Build apps that work well on these more mobile devices, tailored to the interaction model of the mobile device, right, which is your finger. We have gesture affordances in here that we'll be adding. So right now we have tap. We'll do the swiping kind of things and let you do stuff to that, all leveraging that same back-end service. So I think a key there as well is when you think about, hey, how should I think about Silverlight and all those kind of things? The way I think about it for Lightswitch developers is, first of all, you're building a service. That is a .NET service that is a very invested in space with us, right? So everything you put in that service, that's like any other service you create. Your opinion on the future of Silverlight? All right. Now you're deciding how far do you go into customizing that client, right? If I got it up there in a week and the thing lasts for 10 years, that's a pretty good return on investment, I think. And then you're just hoping that Jay and team are going to go and keep building out whatever the other presentation stacks are, right, so that at the point that you decide I need to do a different technology, you have another week to go create it in whatever that technology is with Lightswitch, right? So with that, I know it's kind of last day. These slides are there, just sort of goes through a little more detail of what we've done, how to think about this stuff, blah, blah, blah. You saw all this through demos. So somebody asked you, what is LightSwitch? The way I think about it now, it's the simplest way to create modern line of business applications for the enterprise, right? And all those devices that you need. I'll get you this, lots of resources. Beth will be very happy if you go visit the Dev Center, go visit the team blog, lots of good stuff going on there. And of course, tech ed resources and the evaluation, very important. Please appreciate it. Evaluation, appreciate any comments you have. And you've been very patient. What's your question? So the migration process for LightSwitch or for the server? For LightSwitch, LightSwitch V1 will just open up in LightSwitch 2012 and F5 and you're off and running. No changes. When you add, We did change the OData, so if you went into a really crazy edge that we exposed with Rhea, we'll tell you, hey, we can't do this, you're going to need to put it somewhere else. But so far, of all the apps that we have, we've not found one that used that stuff yet. So for the most part, open up F5 run. On the server, nothing new. We've actually made it easier to deploy. We took away some of those prereq deployment things because we can just deploy it ourselves. But if you deployed to a server with a V1, you'll be able to deploy that same server with V2. Screens and folders. Yeah, what you're kind of hitting on is where I think the biggest people often ask me, like, what size application could I do with this? That usually has two dimensions to it. From a scale point of view, as far as data and concurrent users, there is no concern whatsoever with the scale of a LightSwitch app. We test it with huge data sets, huge concurrent users hitting against it, right? What I think we have right now is a point-in-time developer experience constraint on the size of the project, right? If you get a project with hundreds of screens in it, that's not going to be a real pleasant experience in LightSwitch right now for the developer, right? And that's just something we need to get to. We're just not there yet. We made a lot of improvements in 2012. We don't have one model file anymore. We've broken them apart. So if you are working with multiple people, you will have less merge conflicts on the model file. It's much more obvious how to go separate your work so you have no merge conflicts, all those kinds of things. And that's just a place we'll keep working. And as we feel we're better doing that, then we'll add those other things like putting screens in folders. You already see a little bit of componentization, right, with the fact that I can now have multiple clients, right? So that's a componentization strategy you could use if you wanted to break up stuff. We're getting better with the web deploy side of actually knowing how to do just the diff changes, but we're not quite there yet. So, you know what? I don't want to keep everybody. I'm happy to stay here and take some questions, and then I'm happy to hang out outside as well. I really appreciate you guys spending about an hour and a half with me today. I know it's getting late in the conference, so hopefully it's been a good week, and go start building some LightSwitch apps.